This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Ask your doctor about how HBOT can help you achieve your optimal health. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time to field your questions with the capable assistance of Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mutin. She's a registered dietitian, and she also has gone on to obtain an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. We work together on a daily basis at the Hoffman Center. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. Any news on the nutrition front that you want to share?
I actually podcasted about my on it myself, but the FDA is issuing new nutrition label guidelines to also show added sugars, which is great news. But
good or bad, do you think?
That's good. I think It will be helpful.
Now, however, I've seen some articles that suggest that people simply don't read labels, or if they do read labels, it doesn't influence their behavior that much.
That's true, but I wouldn't say that's absolutely everybody.
Yeah.
Some people are interested. If they see added sugars there, they may think twice about it. I mean, it's not changing the whole ball game. It's not going to forever, you know, get everybody going in the right direction. But I think what's important is that it's important that we recognize that added sugar is more of a detriment to our health than fats ever were.
So before there wasn't even a declaration about that.
Total
sugar.
Right. Which could be naturally occurring.
Right.
You know, but now added sugar in terms of corn syrup, anything like that, or anything that's not normally found in the food itself. However, they're not requiring food companies to implement this until July of 2018. So,
That's like on an episode of Game of Thrones recently. I know you watch Game of Thrones too, where they said, we're going to abolish slavery in 7 years. You have 7 years to abolish slavery in this fictional kingdom on Game of Thrones. So at least we're making some progress. And if people would read labels, it would make a difference. Actually is a study that suggests that Americans are eating slightly better now. Although what the study does show is that while Americans on average are eating slightly better, you know, like the song in the 1930s, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Ain't we got fun? You know, that's a song of the Depression. It seems that, the disparity between the good eaters and the bad eaters is, increasing. So just like income disparity is increasing in this country, diet disparity is increasing. Although on the high end, I think I have to say that in the past 20 or 30 years that I've been shopping, the options are really expanding for healthy eating.
That's true.
Not just, there's a proliferation of, in Manhattan, the old-fashioned supermarket is almost dead.
Yes.
The supermarkets that are around are very high quality. They have lots of organic choices and really healthy choices. And then, of course, there's Whole Foods, that Whole Foods phenomenon. There's Trader Joe's phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the regular good old-fashioned supermarkets are going by the wayside here in the major urban areas. Clearly they're better opportunities. The other thing is that their online opportunities are really abounding. I get, you know, every week or so I get a big package from Thrive Market where I get very interesting products that I can't necessarily track down in the stores.
Right.
And I really increase my pantry with those kind of things.
Wonderful.
It helps support my paleo diet. Just before we get to questions, I want to mention another story. Headline in USA Today, Americans spend billions on non-conventional health approaches. So this is a new study released by the National Center for Health Statistics. Americans spend $30.2 billion out of pocket on complementary health approaches annually. That's a substantial percentage, nearly 10% of the $329 billion spent in total out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures.
Wow.
So this, remember, this is out-of-pocket. This doesn't mean that it, there's a lot more expense in the healthcare sector that's covered by insurance.
Yes.
But it means that Americans are willing to reach into their pockets for this kind of extraordinary care, which I think is great. Researchers estimate 1 in 5 Americans age 4 and over spent money on at least one type of complementary health approach, which could include, and they spelled it wrong here, message therapy. You know what message therapy is? I think I need a message.
Journalism is getting worse and worse. Nobody's proofreading anymore. I'm finding more and more typos. I don't know about you,
but it's the spell check. Well, we have to deal with that in our newsletter every week, and you're the final set of eyeballs that see our newsletter. You do a good job.
Thank you.
So message therapy, Tai Chi, chiropractic manipulation, homeopathic treatment, hypnosis, and energy healing therapy. I guess what that means is that what we're doing at the Hoffman Center has nothing to do with complementary therapy.
I guess.
It's like nutritionally oriented functional medicine is not listed there.
Okay. Not at all. But, you know, we should look into message therapy.
I think so. What we're doing, we are messaging a lot.
We are. It's true.
And I hope that you get the message when we share it with you. Okay, so let's get to questions.
Yes, yes. We've got an email here from Bernice. Bernice writes, could you comment on water intake in regard to low GFR reading, low glomerular filtration rate reading.
Say that again 5 times over fast.
Oh, I can't.
Glomerular.
Bravo. Okay. I can't do it.
Okay, so the glomerulus is this tiny little filtration unit. It's microscopic in the kidneys. And it's actually, in some ways, similar to a structure in the lungs called the alveolus. The glomeruli, plural, are like the alveoli, where there's an exchange in the lungs where it's the air interface with the blood. In the kidneys, it's the blood interface with the outside excretion of urine. So these are like little tiny filters. So anyway, when your kidney function is impaired, your GFR, or your glomerular flow rate,
flow
is decreased.
Rate, not filtration.
It's usually filtration rate, actually.
All right, okay.
F for flow, F for filtration. So in a healthy adult, it's usually above 60, I think is the cutoff. Under 60 is compromised. Under 30 or 20 is pretty severe renal insufficiency.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ways that they calculate whether you might have impaired kidneys or on your way to dialysis, in fact. So clearly your hydration has something to do with your flow rate, because if you don't take any water, there aren't no flow rate. You don't produce any, you know, flow.
Right, right. And in addition, those with renal insufficiency, or actually more like renal failure with a very low GFR, they may be advised by their nephrologist, their kidney doctor, to drink less water.
Because they will blow up.
They will blow up if they don't. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So
that makes sense.
You can over and you can under. But usually over is not so much of a problem with people who have a normal filtration.
Yes.
But if you don't have good filtration, you simply won't excrete that excess water.
And that can wind up as edema, I guess, anywhere else in the body.
A sign of kidney failure is that, you know, people say, well, I have puffy dust in the eyes. Well, usually that's nothing. It's allergies. Sometimes it can be a sign of hypothyroidism, it can be a sign of congestive heart failure, but puffiness under the eyes and general body edema can be a sign of severe renal failure.
So, Bernice, don't look at your GFR and determine by yourself whether you need more or less water. The only time you would be advised to drink less water would be by your nephrologist. Because, you know, that's really
clearly
the only.
Yep.
Yeah. Because that would have its own dangers. Dehydration, for one. Thank you very much for your question. Okay, we've got an email from Cindy. She talks about, Dr. Hoffman, your article in the newsletter, What's Your Health IQ Round 2? And your question number 5, excess vitamin A, niacin, and iron have all been found to cause liver damage. But how much? How do I know what's too much vitamin A, niacin, and iron to take?
Well, the answer is that it's different strokes for different folks. So, let's take them one by one. You know, vitamin A, you know, people can take fairly high doses of vitamin A without toxicity. You can take probably up to 25,000 with usually yeah. without toxicity, but it accumulates in the liver. And it if someone were to take hypothetically, 100,000 or 200,000 a day, day in and day out for a while, you might start to get liver toxicity.
Yeah.
So actually, a documented case of toxicity, one of the first documented cases of liver toxicity due to vitamin A occurred in polar explorers. Polar explorers were advised by their Indian guides when they shot polar bears for food not to eat the liver. And they said they ignored the advice of their Indian guides, and they Native American guides, and or Eskimo guides in this case, and they ate the liver. They said, that's the best part. Come on, the liver is the best part. But it turns out that the liver is a repository for vitamin A yeah. in these polar bears. And polar bears need a lot of vitamin A for rhodopsin in the eye. That's the black and white rods mm-hmm. in the eye are vitamin A dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And in the polar environment, there because it's so bright and at times very dark and dim,
mm-hmm.
There's a tremendous amount of vitamin A in the bodies of these polar bears, but particularly in the liver. So these guys got vitamin A toxicity from eating polar bear liver.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So I suppose in a multi, how much would we actually look for?
Well, I kept it to, there's toxicity is different than too much that could be no good for other reasons. So
yeah.
We now know that vitamin A above about 10 or 15,000 a day can be associated with some higher risk for osteoporosis.
Hmm.
And also for expectant moms or, you know, moms contemplating pregnancy.
For osteoporosis?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There's also some evidence that it's can cause birth defects at higher
yeah.
doses.
Yeah.
So generally, prenatals have a lot less vitamin A and more mixed carotenoids.
Yeah.
So I think our
Which is the precursor.
Our multi has mm-hmm. 5,000 and it's more... There's a lot more mixed carotenoids.
Yes.
It's like half and half mixed carotenoids and half
vitamin A.
Yeah. I mean, you need vitamin A, but...
Totally.
Where some people got into trouble with that is they used vitamin A for acne.
Yes.
Really high doses, and it's...
Retin A.
Yeah.
Was the...
Accutane is actually the oral medication.
Accutane,
and
not
Accutane
retin A.
is a yeah. synthetic analog of vitamin A,
mm-hmm.
Which is good for acne, but it has a lot of horrible side effects.
Yeah.
And it can cause really dry skin, palmar erythema, redness of the palms and the hands,
yeah.
Cracks around the mouth, and it can also cause liver damage. And
mm-hmm.
it can even increase the risk for inflammatory bowel disease. I'm not saying that vitamin A does all these things and you shouldn't take any, but it shows that there is toxicity at really high doses.
Yeah.
And when you take Accutane, it's like taking, you know, like 500,000 or a million
Right.
vitamin A. It's really
Which you're
expensive.
Not going to necessarily find in a supplement unless you're overdoing your supplement. Or something.
Yeah.
But there's really
were
no supplement
potent
that's
drops, vitamin yeah. A drops in the past that could potentially, if you took like 10 drops a day, you could run pretty high levels of vitamin A.
I wonder if people taking cod liver oil run into that problem.
That's one of the downsides of cod liver oil. If you really take too much, you can get you're getting vitamin D, which is good, and you're
yeah.
getting the EPA, DHA, but you're also getting a lot of vitamin A, so that's potentially
right.
a downside.
Right. And then with niacin.
Let's go niacin, yeah.
Yeah. Well, niacin is helpful for a whole lot of things. Treatment for schizophrenia, treatment for
high cholesterol. Right.
All of that helping to raise possibly HDL, but we have to monitor liver function,
right.
don't we?
And some patients get liver abnormalities at fairly low doses of like maybe even 200 milligrams.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So with other people, they can take 500, 1,000, 1,500, usually around 500 to 1,000, you're going to start to see some slight increases in your liver functions.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually occurs also with statin drugs, which also lower cholesterol. And it's permitted with statin drugs. Doctors see that and they go, oh, well, the statin
yeah.
drug's stressing the liver a little bit, no big deal. But we also have to look at it this way, is if you have liver disease,
mm-hmm.
then you really need to watch out for these things.
Totally. Yeah.
If you don't, then you don't have to be quite as careful, and it's also some people have a greater capacity to handle this better liver function than others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then the other one was mentioned was...
Iron.
Yeah, iron at super high doses can cause liver problems.
Right, right. You know, I've not seen that.
I'm not seeing that either.
Yeah. But I want to warn anybody listening, you know, you don't want to self-prescribe an iron supplement because you say it makes you feel better, it makes you more energetic.
Geritol.
Yes, it does.
The geritol effect. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you remember that?
Yeah.
Unless you have iron deficiency anemia, it's really not advised to take an iron supplement on your own. The reason for that is because iron can accumulate in the body. A, it could feed infection.
Right.
B, if you accumulate enough in your body, it could become toxic to the heart.
Well, so to give you an idea, the people who have a condition of overabsorption of iron,
hemochromatosis,
they typically have liver abnormalities, and they can even develop liver cirrhosis from hemochromatosis because all the iron gets deposited in the liver and damages the liver. It'll damage other organs, but it seems to be particularly have an affinity for the liver.
Yeah.
So then the other one was there another?
That was it. Vitamin A, niacin, and iron.
Okay.
For liver damage.
Okay.
I'll tell you, the most that I see in terms of people with elevated liver enzymes are people who have self-prescribed iron.
Right.
And have self-prescribed red yeast rice.
Oh, okay. That's another interesting one. I mean, red rice yeast is much milder than statin drugs.
Yeah.
So I think it might be hard unless you really took like a lot of tablets.
Mm-hmm.
I used to give 4 tablets of the standardized, I think it's 600 milligrams per tablet. So I'm giving 2,400 and I never saw liver problems with that. And rarely side effects such as people have with statins. Although occasionally people will say they have that leg achiness that's associated with statins when they take the red yeast rice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Cindy, thank you for your very thoughtful question. So we've got a question here from Arthur. Actually, we have 2 questions about the same topic, which is carpal tunnel syndrome. Arthur writes, "You have a great and informative show. I wanted to ask about carpal tunnel syndrome. I was told years ago that taking approximately 400 milligrams of vitamin B6 for several weeks and then reducing the dose would relieve the symptoms. I haven't been able to find anything about this. Now, is there any danger to trying this?"
Yeah, there was a Dr. Ellis, I believe, who did this initial research and found that B6 was helpful for carpal tunnel syndrome. B6 seems to have a good effect on nerve pain, and that is a form of nerve pain.
Right.
However, at the doses that are necessary to treat carpal tunnel syndrome, there is a risk of neuropathy from very high doses of vitamin B6. That's also been reported. So it's good for nerve pain, but too much is bad for nerve pain.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to be a little careful with that dose range. I think, you know, 250 to 500 is okay.
Yes, and even though it's a water-soluble vitamin, there is still that risk. When you're taking such high doses of it, you could take it for a short period of time. It could be very helpful. But beyond that, our second question on carpal tunnel syndrome, this is very interesting. Rick writes, "You guys will be one of the lovely sober media alternatives over the next 5 months to Clinton and Trump."
You know, I gotta say that's a really interesting comment because, for many people, and I don't want to tread on anybody's political loyalties, this political campaign is pretty dismaying.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have the prospect of being inundated with very partisan messages from one or another. You can pick your party, you know, virtually with the cable news channel that you select. And you're going to get just hammered and hammered and hammered and hammered with information that is aggravating.
Yes.
So, you know, this may be a good time to cultivate other habits.
Yes.
Read a good book, do some exercise, do some meditation, get involved in a fascinating TV series.
Listen to these podcasts. Anyway, Rick writes, "A friend had tingling and numbness in her hands from carpal tunnel. After surgery on one, the tingling went away, but she still had numbness and now also has a tight, sometimes painful scar in the palm of her hand. The doctor said this result is a rarity, and he wants to operate again now to remove the scar from the nerve. She tried ultrasound. Is there anything else she can do? And what's best for carpal tunnel now, in the other hand? First of all, not enough attention is given. I've had carpal tunnel in the past, over 20 years ago.
Right.
Surgery is not the first order of business. Physical therapy is fantastic. Okay. The B vitamins are great.
You had a different job then. You were like a...
Yes.
You were tapping
I was
on.
An executive secretary.
Right.
And we were getting ready to launch a new network, and I was literally typing 14 hours a day. Until one day,
ESPN, right?
I did, yes. Until one day, I went into my boss. I said, "I can't feel my pinky anymore."
Wow!
And you know,
and those you had like an IBM Selectric or something like that, probably.
Oh no! We were on computer. This was back in the early 90s.
Okay, but also computers have a disadvantage.
Yeah.
You cock up your hands
exactly.
at an angle. Like,
I mean, this was before the days of ergonomically correct seating having the wrist rest on your keyboard. After that is when all this came into play. But so. The first order of business is this can be a repetitive motion injury.
RSI.
RSI. And that could be from typing. It could be from if you use your hands in other ways, whether it's knitting or playing a musical instrument or some other things that you may be doing. It is also, carpal tunnel is also a result of insulin resistance.
Yes.
It's actually a symptom of insulin resistance. You have to look at that too.
Right.
But
here's another one. It's also related to hypothyroidism. Because when you have hypothyroidism, you get what's called myxedema, which is a general edematous situation where you accumulate water. And when your hands accumulate water, there's a very narrow tunnel called the carpal tunnel. It gets compressed.
Uh-huh.
So the swelling will create compression and will give you tingling numbness and pain. So treating a patient with thyroid and thus getting rid of excess water will often help that.
Right, right.
If it's appropriate.
Now, this surgeon wants to now remove the scar from the nerve. If that's going to happen, and you know, surgery is typically a last resort in carpal tunnel syndrome, but then if you're asking a surgeon about it, then it's your, that would be the first thing they do. But if you're gonna ever have any kind of surgery, including this one, you wanna take bromelain after the surgery to prevent adhesions.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough people know this.
Right.
And, few surgeons will ever recommend it because I think they don't know themselves, possibly.
So I'm reading here from Dr. Jonathan Wright, who's actually one of the people who popularized B6 after Dr. John Ellis wrote about it. Dr. John Ellis actually first published this information in 1971 in a book called The Doctor Who Looked at Hands, and then he wrote a book called Vitamin B6, The Doctor's Report in 1973. And according to Dr. Wright, he says that every time he's asked anyone with this problem to try the B6 protocol since 1975, it hasn't failed once.
Mm-hmm.
So we've somewhat updated the protocol to include a more activated form of B6, which is called P5P, pyridoxal 5-phosphate. And the recommended dosage of that is 50 milligrams of P5P 3 times daily. And you got to do it for 6 months. It's gradual, but there should definitely be a response.
Yeah.
It says it can take up to 6 months, although many less serious cases take considerably less time. And here's an additional dividend. The problem of trigger finger is often helped by this protocol. So,
what's trigger finger?
Trigger finger is like when your finger can't unfurl. Typically, it occurs in the morning, and by later in the day, the finger can, you know, unfurl. But it's a weird condition where it's like a proliferation of synovial membrane or swelling that prevents the finger from completely unfurling. And you can sort of mechanically bend your finger back, but it hampers your hand motion.
Is that from too much target practice?
Yeah. It's like NRA members get that.
Oh, my gosh. Arthur and Rick, thank you very, very much for your questions.
Make my day.
Okay. We've got another question from Elaine. Elaine writes, love you both. My go-to podcast and radio program for the most up-to-date and insightful health info. Thank you, Elaine. I have read that DHEA might be helpful in increasing the quality of eggs for fertility. Any info you can offer would be helpful. Thank you once again for sharing your knowledge.
Can we do this? Because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. And what we should do is let's hold that question over for part two. When we return, we'll talk about the role that DHEA may play in enhancing fertility. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla on Intelligent Medicine.